Good morning. I've been asked this morning, my part of the presentation, panel presentation, to provide the context for Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life. Much of what we know through about the German resistance movement to Nazi Germany comes from Martin Niemöller, a contemporary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's, a German pastor who was in prison for much of World War II because of his own resistance to the Nazis. One of my favorite stories that comes from Niemöller is a story about his interaction with the prison chaplain. Niemöller was in a Berlin prison at the time for speaking out against Hitler and his policies. This chaplain, a man whom Niemöller had known for years, and a man known to be a Nazi stooge, once approached him and said, "Why, Pastor Niemöller," using an accusatory tone, "why, Pastor Niemöller, why are you in here?" Niemöller, without even pausing, turned, stared right at him and said, "No, sir, the question is not why am I in here, but why are you out there?" Niemöller's story is effective because it illustrates the tension that existed between Christians in Germany who acquiesced to the power of Hitler, some who even embraced it, and then German Christians who resisted it. It is also significant because it raises important questions. Perhaps first and foremost of this is, why would the German people support Hitler's rise to power in the first place? After all, this is a man who would imprison a pastor simply for speaking out against his policies. It is a man who came to power not by a coup, but by being supported by the German people. Why would they do such a thing? Well, let me suggest that when we look in retrospect at the activities of the Nazis, it is easy for us to dismiss the Germans as being an evil or a militaristic people who are simply bent on the same destruction that the Nazis used. The context of the interwar years, however, suggests something much different. It suggests that instead of being an evil people, they were a desperate people. World War I ended badly for the Germans, to say the least. Not only did they lose to their fellow powers in Europe, not only did they lose national prestige, but they were forced to sign a war guilt clause in the treaty that ended World War I, a war guilt clause that proclaimed them to be the sole reason for the militarism in Europe. They were a people defeated, not only literally, but they were defeated on the battlefield, but they were defeated in spirit. In addition to that, the government that was forced upon them by the victorious powers of World War I, the Weimar Republic, proved itself to be weak and unstable. Thus, when they had significant problems arise, economic and social problems, this government could do nothing about it. And the German people became frustrated with them, with the Weimar Republic. They looked, for example, when the Great World Depression brought high inflation and high unemployment. An unemployment that Dietrich Bonhoeffer once suggested was so high that 7 million men were out of work at one time, which he then went on to explain would mean that 15 to 20 men, women, and children would either be hungry or starving. They looked at this situation and became more and more desperate, looking for a leader, because desperate people look for strong leaders who promise to deliver a better future for them. And Adolf Hitler provided the facade of strong leadership. He, after all, we often forget this, was a mesmerizing public speaker. He had personal charisma, and he could deliver a speech that would draw the whole crowd in, with everyone sitting on the edge of their chairs. Well, in addition to that charisma, he had a nationalistic message that resonated with the German people, a message that promised to deliver a better Germany for them. A message that, unfortunately, also had a very negative side to it. The nationalistic side in and of itself is bad enough, but when you go to the other side of it, you see that he begins to blame the problems of Germany on others. Certainly, his fellow European powers had something to do with this, but he also began scapegoating, blaming the Jews in particular for the problems that were occurring in Germany. The Jews, he said, were a culture-destroying race. And that cultural-destroying race was a drag on the Germans, the Aryan race that was culture-creating. It was a message that set the foundations for the atrocities of the Holocaust. It was also a message that should have been heard by the Christians in Germany, because he was preaching this nationalistic and this scapegoating message early on. Unfortunately, many Christians did not pay attention. So the second question, and a question that goes back to the story between Niemöller and this chaplain, is why so many Christians would be like that chaplain and either embrace Hitler's leadership or at least acquiesce to it. Well, it's a subject that we could spend hours on, but I don't have that time. So let me suggest a couple of things that are worth looking at. A couple of elements of here. First of all, Hitler promised religious liberty. He promised freedom to the churches. If they would leave him alone, he would leave them alone. In particular, he said to Christians in the day, as he was rising to power, Christians in Germany, as he was rising to power, that he had no interest in the religious activities of the day. He was only concerned about the affairs of the state, the economic and political and social situation, not concerned about religious affairs. And many, unfortunately, believed him until they realized it was too late. And perhaps the best example of this came in July 1933 when he signed a concordat with the Vatican where the Roman Catholic Church officially recognized Hitler's regime on the promise that he would leave their educational programs and their churches alone. And of course, in recognizing their regime, they also promised the German bishops and priests that they would not preach against Hitler and his regime. They gave up their right to have a prophetic voice in order to get a measure of religious liberty. Well, in addition to that, I would say that other Christians in Germany, those who embraced Hitler, also fell for his civil religious rhetoric. We do not think of Hitler in these terms, but Hitler early on littered his speeches with civil religious rhetoric, where he would intertwine the history and destiny of Germany with the will of God. So his message that Germany could be great again was always one that suggested that God had a place in this. For Christians who were desperate, looking for a place, an opportunity to have a voice in their society, and looking for a better future, this was a hope, a promise. And despite the fact that Hitler's rhetoric was too general and too vague to be true New Testament Christianity, they overlooked that because they were so desperate that God would redeem them as a people and help them come to a better future. This is true of the lay people. It's also true of religious leaders of the day who unfortunately did not use the discernment they should have in listening to this because they were hopeful that if he would speak in religious terms, that would give them a chance to shape Germany in the next few years. Just to have the idea of political and social involvement to them was enough for them to follow him, or at least not oppose him. Well, last of all, the Niemöller interaction with this chaplain, I think, raises one more question. That is this. Why did these Christians like Niemöller and Bonhoeffer and others who resisted Hitler, why were they different than these other Christians, these other German Christians that gave up their right to speak prophetically? Well, let me suggest two things. First of all, they understood that Christians should never abandon eternal principles in the face of immediate concerns and problems. They understood that Christians should never abandon eternal principles in the face of immediate concerns. They saw the high unemployment and the high inflation. They saw the other problems that other Christians did. But they looked beyond that and looked at Hitler and his Nazi regime and realized that the principles that they were living by and governing by did not square with New Testament Christianity. They did not want to abandon that. And then lastly, I think that unlike the biblical character Esau and the compliant German Christians, they refused to sell the birthright of their faith for the stew of civil religious platitudes. It's not enough that we hear public officials use religious language and say that must mean that we have a place. We must also use discernment to make sure that that squares with what the Bible teaches us, with what the historic Christian tradition teaches us. Those who resisted Hitler demanded that they do better and not just give them these platitudes. It is our hope that we will all have such courage and such discernment. And because of that, I want to give Walter and Dr. Pradelford a chance to come and talk about the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
It's appropriate that we spend this chapel session thinking about the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a great 20th century theologian. This is indeed the 60th anniversary year of his execution at the hand of the Nazis, so we are thinking about his work today. I'd like to give you a little brief outline of his life. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was born in Breslau, Germany, along with his twin sister, Sabine, on February the 4th, 1906. His parents were Karl Bonhoeffer and Paula von Haas Bonhoeffer. Their genealogies include professors, theologians, and other professional people for many generations. The family was literate, highly educated, and solidly middle class. They were not noted for their regular church attendance. Young Dietrich was musically gifted and became a good pianist. After failing to win a music scholarship to the university, he announced to his family that he had decided to study theology, which was a great surprise to them. In 1927, Dietrich completed his doctoral dissertation on the communion of the saints. He was only 21 years old. Karl Barth, the great Swiss theologian, proclaimed Bonhoeffer's dissertation a theological miracle. In 1928, Dietrich accepted an appointment as assistant pastor of a German congregation in Barcelona. In 1929, he completed a second dissertation, Act and Being, as a requirement for an academic appointment at the University of Berlin. With his academic appointment secure, he was free to accept a Sloan Fellowship to study at Union Theological Seminary in 1930. He learned from his professor, Reinhold Niebuhr, the relationship between the gospel and social action. From his Union professors, he incorporated pragmatism and emphasis on responsible action that would later animate his anti-Hitler activities. Bonhoeffer's good friend at Union Seminary was Franklin Fisher, an African-American student with whom he attended the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. Of much American preaching, Bonhoeffer said that one can hear sermons about almost everything except sin, forgiveness, and redemption. It was at the Abyssinian Baptist Church that Bonhoeffer heard the gospel preached with rapturous passion and, I believe, became born again. From Jean Lasserre, a French seminarian, he gained a deeper commitment to the principles of the Sermon on the Mount. Lasserre pinpointed the turning point in Bonhoeffer's pacifism to a Sunday afternoon when they viewed the film All Quiet on the Western Front. They were saddened to the point of tears at the lighthearted reaction of the children in the theater to the killing portrayed on the screen. In 1931, Bonhoeffer went back to Berlin and resumed university lecturing. He was a very popular teacher, particularly with those students who did not gravitate toward Nazism. On January 30, 1933, Adolf Hitler was made Chancellor of Germany. 2 days later, on February 1, 1933, Bonhoeffer made a radio address in which he warned against the cult of the Führer, or leader, who might very well become a misleader. His radio program was cut short by the Nazis, which may be the first restriction on the freedom of speech by them. On September 21, 1933, Bonhoeffer, along with three other pastors, formed the Pastors' Emergency League, whose aim was to fight for a Christ-honoring confession of faith within the church. This was necessary because already on September the 4th, 1933, at the so-called Brown Synod, the Nazification of the church had begun, with pastors being required to take a personal oath of allegiance to Adolf Hitler. On October 17th, 1933, Bonhoeffer began a pastorate of two German congregations in London, where he became friends with George Bell, the Bishop of Chichester. On May 29th through 31st, 1934, the Confessing Church was organized at Barmen. This produced the famous Barman Confession of Faith, which was practically written by Karl Barth. No other Lords but Jesus Christ was the theme of the confession. The weakness of the document was in not being outspoken enough on behalf of the Jews. What had happened here was a group of Christians basically pulled out of the state Lutheran Church in Germany because of its weak Christian stand and its weak stand against Hitler, and also to preserve the true preaching of the gospel. And the Confessing Church was formed in Germany. In October 1934, the Dahlem Synod of the Confessing Church took the radical step of organizing their own training for pastoral candidates. This training school was to be funded by the free will offerings of the parishioners. Bonhoeffer was invited to form this seminary. He writes to Erwin Sutz, "I am struggling over the decision on whether I should go back to Germany as director of the new preacher's seminary, still to be established, or whether I should remain here in England, or go to India to visit Gandhi and study passive resistance. I no longer believe in the university, and never really have believed in it, a fact that used to rile you. The entire training of young theologians belongs today in church, monastic-like schools, in which the pure doctrine, the Sermon on the Mount, and worship can be taken seriously, which is really not the case with all three things at the university, and in present-day circumstances is impossible." On August the 2nd, 1934, President Hindenburg died, and Hitler was made president and chancellor of Germany. In April of 1935, the preacher's seminary under Bonhoeffer's tutelage opened and eventually settled in Finkenwalde. Here, he met Ruth von Kleist-Retzau, a strong Christian from an old Prussian family who became a close friend. Bonhoeffer also became acquainted with the granddaughter of Mrs. Kleist-Retzau, Maria von Wedemeyer. The Finkenwald Seminary was closed by the Gestapo in 1937. Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass, occurred on November the 9th, 1938. Only a few pastors from the Confessing Church raised a voice in protest. Because of this deteriorating situation in the Confessing Church, Bonhoeffer began to be more aware of the activities of his brother-in-law, Hans von Dohnányi, who, with a group of military men in the Abwehr, or counterintelligence movement, were planning an overthrow of the Hitler regime. Bonhoeffer avoided the military draft through a visiting lectureship at Union Theological Seminary in June of 1939. However, he stayed only a month. He returned to Germany on July the 8th, 1939, on one of the last ships before the outbreak of World War II. He says, "I have made a mistake in coming to America. I must live through this difficult period of our national history with the Christian people of Germany. I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. Christians in Germany will face the terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying our civilization. I know which of these alternatives I must choose, but I cannot make that decision in security." Bonhoeffer, at this point, obviously through his own decision, was brought into the group of Abwehr conspirators. He was declared to be indispensable to their work and given liberal traveling privileges. During this time as a traveling double agent, he spent some time at the monastery in Ettal in Bavaria, where he began work on his book, Ethics. On January 17, 1943, at the age of 37, Bonhoeffer became engaged to Maria von Wedemeyer, aged 17. Their growth and heartfelt love for each other is amazing, particularly during Dietrich's prison days. On April the 5th, 1943, Dietrich was arrested and imprisoned in Tegel Prison in Berlin. From this time until his death in 1945, Dietrich wrote many letters to Maria, family, friends, and his good friend Eberhard Bethge. From this correspondence, we have the volume Letters and Papers from Prison, which forms another rich source of theological insight for the church. During his last days, Bonhoeffer met Payne Best, a British Secret Service officer. He writes of Bonhoeffer, "He always seemed to diffuse an atmosphere of happiness, of joy, and every smallest event of life, and a deep gratitude for the mere fact that he was alive. He was one of the very few men I have ever met to whom his God was real and ever close to him." Bonhoeffer was different from the other prisoners, just quite calm and normal, seemingly perfectly at his ease. His soul really shone in the dark desperation of our prison. Bonhoeffer conducted a prayer service and meditation for his fellow prisoners on April 8, 1945. His texts were from Isaiah, "With his stripes we are healed," and 1 Peter, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. By God's great mercy we have been born anew to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." Payne Best states that Bonhoeffer reached the hearts of all, finding just the right words to express the spirit of our imprisonment. Two evil-looking men immediately entered and said, "Prisoner Bonhoeffer, come with us." This, of course, meant the death penalty. Bonhoeffer spoke to Payne Best, "This is the end, for me, the beginning of life." The next day, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was hanged at Flossenbürg concentration camp. The prison doctor said, "I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer, before taking off his prison garb, kneeling on the floor, praying fervently to his God. I was most deeply moved by the way this lovable man prayed, so devout and so certain that God heard his prayer." At the place of execution, he again said a short prayer and then climbed the steps to the gallows, brave and composed. In the almost 50 years that I worked as a doctor, I have hardly ever seen a man die so entirely submissive to the will of God. Dr. Gushing.
I'd like to thank Beth Pierce for putting together the PowerPoint that you are seeing as a part of the presentation this morning. These are pictures of Dietrich Bonhoeffer from various stages of his life, as well as pictures from the Nazi era and from what the Nazis did to the Jewish people during the Holocaust. So hope that that has been clear to you. My assignment is to reflect on Dietrich Bonhoeffer's writings, but I would also, I guess, like to reflect what I would say is the theological or spiritual meaning of his life for us. And to do that, I would like to revisit the text that we started with and read a little bit more from Matthew chapter 16, 24 through 28. The word of the Lord. "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he has done. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." In a sense, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life and his writings can be seen as a commentary on this single text of Scripture. As you have heard already, Bonhoeffer was born into comfort. This must be understood. He came from money, class, and status. There was no question that he would have the resources and the ability to enjoy a successful and comfortable life for himself in whatever field that he would choose. He initially decided to become a theologian, I think mainly because it was a quiet way of rebelling against his secularized family. It was a profession, but it was one that would surprise them. Whatever profession he chose, he was heading towards a comfortable life among the German intelligentsia. The life of a professor is very highly esteemed in Germany. He would be Dr. Professor Bonhoeffer and live out his days in comfort and status and wealth. But the times intervened. The Nazis rose to power at just about the same time that Bonhoeffer was launching his career. By this time, Bonhoeffer had truly committed himself to Christ. He didn't do anything halfway, so this presented a problem for him. Because in Germany, professors were and are employees of the state. So this meant that in 1933 Germany, professors like Bonhoeffer were employees of the Nazi state. So this meant that in effect, for a brief time, Professor Bonhoeffer was an employee of Adolf Hitler. And this was not going to last very long. Many professional people in Nazi Germany found a way to go along with Hitler. And I want you to get a sense of how easy it would be to do that. Even if they found him personally quite distasteful, they found a way. They got along. They wore the Nazi armbands with the swastika everybody was supposed to wear. They made the Hitler salute in class to start their classes. They joined the Nazi professional associations, and there were professional associations for every kind of work. Maybe they joined the Nazi party if they wanted to be especially careful and ensure a good future for themselves in Nazi Germany. After all, you know, a man has to feed his family, right? Isn't that the way people think? This is how deadly moral compromises are born. I'll compromise here and compromise there, and I know where to draw the line. But Bonhoeffer did not begin the process of compromising. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul? Bonhoeffer was unwilling to exchange his soul for the world, at least the world that was led by Adolf Hitler. And so both his life and his work became acts of resistance to Hitler and to the ideology of Hitler and to the spread of this ideology in the life of the German people, and especially the spread of this ideology as a poison and as a heresy in the German church. Bonhoeffer saw more clearly than almost anyone else in Germany that the church was woefully unprepared for the moral challenge and the theological challenge that Nazism presented. And so he turned his intellectual energies to fighting for a relevant, biblical, and resistant Christianity in Germany. He noticed, for example, and all of this is relevant to us, that many Protestants in Germany understood the Christian faith or the gospel message to consist entirely of the good news of salvation by grace through faith, and that all Christians need to do is believe this good news and receive this salvation. Sound familiar? This posture had turned Germany's Christians into passive grace receivers rather than active disciples. They had been trained to think that being Christian did not require any particular moral commitments or social involvements. One could be a Christian and a Nazi without a problem. Or one could be a Christian and completely disengaged from a deteriorating cultural situation. Just go to church and pray and go home and go about your life. Instead, in The Cost of Discipleship, one of Bonhoeffer's most important books, working with the Sermon on the Mount, Bonhoeffer said that Christian faith requires costly obedience to Jesus Christ. He also said that the church must move from a sleepy irrelevance to culture right into the center of culture, where it can then be ready to follow Jesus wherever he may lead. Not to take over culture or dominate it, but to serve it at its greatest points of need, and to serve those who are victimized by culture. This still speaks to us today. Bonhoeffer's years spent leading a seminary of the Confessing Church were an effort to reform a deeply compromised, even Nazified, church. I mean, this church went so far in many circles as to throw out Jewish members or people who had any Jewish heritage, because that's what the Nazis wanted. Could you imagine that kind of compromise? Bonhoeffer said, no, this must not happen. And so he led or participated in leading a radical alteration of how ministers were trained. His book, Life Together, was a reflection on this experience, and in it he explores the nature of disciplined Christian community. The impulse behind both this Confessing Church seminary and the book was this: a national community that is turning evil can only be resisted by a church community that is strong and disciplined and biblical and more knowledgeable about the times and about what is really going on than the adversary. Ready to do what it has to do to resist evil in the name of Christ. This is a muscular kind of Christian faith, a resistant kind of Christian faith, an active kind of faith. It is not a coincidence that many of the young ministers who studied with Bonhoeffer in this seminary ended up resisting the Nazis. And many of them ended up dead, not just Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was remarkably Christ-centered in his thought, and I want to call attention to this. In both his early book, Christ the Center, and his wartime essays, Ethics, Bonhoeffer focuses relentlessly on Jesus Christ, Christ incarnate, Christ the ambassador of the kingdom, Christ crucified, and Christ risen. He says that Christian morality is not an abstract set of principles to be applied, but instead the reshaping of the self so that it conforms to the self of Jesus Christ. He emphasized very much the suffering of Christ on the cross, his solidarity with humanity in our suffering, and his vicarious sacrifice on our behalf. He said that any faithful church must be found among the suffering, among the humiliated, among the victimized, because that is where Christ was found. Indeed, it was who Christ was. Bonhoeffer also noted that the desire for a Messiah, for a Redeemer, a Deliverer, is a permanent part of human history. If people do not accept the real Messiah, they will embrace a false one. Clearly, he was thinking of Hitler and the ecstatic response of the German people to the one they falsely believed was their Messiah. It sounds like a meditation on Jesus saying to his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." As Hitler seduced his millions, many of them supposedly Christians, Bonhoeffer focused ever more relentlessly on Christ. And in doing so, he noticed that Christ stood with the victimized, that he entered the suffering that they suffered and entered it on their behalf. It is not a coincidence, then, that Bonhoeffer was among the very few German Christians to stand up for the Jews who were increasingly persecuted and eventually annihilated by the Nazis. It's also not a coincidence that he concluded that standing with the victims meant doing something concrete to resist the victimizers, the persecutors. And so, when given the opportunity, this theologian pastor joined an influential resistance cell and conspired with them to bring down Hitler and his regime. He became a conspirator, a political conspirator. What a move. How many theologians and ministers do something like that? And this, of course, eventually sent him to prison and then to the gallows. He spent 2 long years in prison, from which he offered some of his most profound writings, including Ethics and Letters and Papers from Prison. These documents mark the climax of his effort to craft a Christian faith of costly obedience in the midst of a pagan culture. He wrote about the church. He lamented its impotence in resisting Hitler. He called for it to confess its sin and to lead the way in confessing the sins of Germany. He suggested that Christians, true Christians, should form alliances with morally concerned non-Christians to resist Nazism. He tried to establish once and for all the permanent significance of ethical concern in the life of the church. He said, yes, justification by grace through faith is the ultimate word, but ethics is the penultimate or next to ultimate word. There is always a place for both. He said that we must participate precisely because we are Christians in the struggles that take place in this world for justice. He emphasized that all of reality is under the lordship of Christ, and we are not free to bracket off any area of life, such as politics, and say that Christ does not rule here, Hitler rules here. Christ is Lord. He is Lord of all countries. He is Lord of all regimes. He is Lord of the church. He is Lord of the universe. So this means that no government has the freedom to do just whatever it feels like doing. Genocide violates Christ's lordship and must be resisted in the name of Christ. When the state turns evil, the church must resist, standing with the victims and seeing reality from the underside of history, where the suffering live. Finally, Bonhoeffer emphasized that the Christian moral life is about following Jesus. He said that while there are objective moral standards, there is a dimension of our discipleship that involves our own interpretation of what Jesus Christ requires us to do. While sitting in a Nazi jail, Bonhoeffer was saying that the path that had taken him there was the path of discipleship. He had obeyed Christ's command to him as he understood that command. He went to his death believing this, not in pride, but in humility, but still with a kind of a humble self-assurance that he had died doing what he was called to do. Jesus said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it." I think the question this leaves each of us is, what does it mean to each of us and our specific calling in life to deny ourselves and take up our cross and follow Jesus.
Thank you, Dr. Gesche and Dr. Padelford, Professor Bates. Would you stand for our benediction? And now to Him who is able to keep you from stumbling and to present you blameless before the presence of His glory with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, through Jesus Christ our Lord, be glory, majesty, dominion, and authority before all time, and now and forever. Amen. You're dismissed.